Okay, this is apologetics class number 6, actually, believe it or not. And by the way, what we're going to cover tonight is actually something I'm going to share with a group of people tomorrow on the radio. So if you happen to be awake at 12 midnight, Friday night, which is Saturday morning from 12 a.m. to 2 a.m., you could tune in 99.5. We'll be live talking about this stuff. So I'm hosting the show, and it's something I do once a month with a team of people I serve with, and it's really fun. It's quite tiresome because, as you can imagine, you think strange thoughts at that hour, and you get some strange callers. So, yeah. So what I was going to say, if you guys want to call in with your questions, we'll take them. And I'm hosting, so I'll take them. And if I see your name there, I'll definitely get you on live so you can be on the air. Well, yeah, it's this actual topic that we'll be talking about tonight, intelligent design.
Is it call-in debate style, or is it like...
Yeah, you just call and ask questions, kind of like, what's up with that, you know, and, or I like this, or whatever. Some people typically don't ask questions. Some people ask questions, but a lot of people just call in and, you know, give their view on something, and we have to cut them off because they go off topic. So that's what happens often, is that people just start rambling. They don't, because we're paying for the program, the airtime, our organization. And so they used to do that for us, but the station won't do that anymore. I guess so, yeah. And I guess we could screen our own calls, but we just stopped doing that too. So whatever, we just let most of them through. And it's really fun, but honestly, like, it's hard to think that late at night. So when I go, like, I'm loading up on coffee, and it still sometimes doesn't help because it's just late. So I do it monthly, but we do it weekly. The other teams go when I'm not there. So anyway, that's fun, and that's tomorrow night. So I want to let you know you guys could do that. 99.5 KKLA. It's at 12 a.m. to 2 a.m. And you could always catch the podcast of our shows a few days later on our website, apologetics.com. All right, so let's get moving. Okay, I'll draw your attention to the first page again, because there's an error that was pointed out last time we met. And I know none of this is fresh in your minds because you had a week off and everything. So I just wanted to tell you that this has been updated, and there are some clarifications made here. And you could stare at it and look at it on your own time, but I don't want to spend the time to get into it again. But I do want to go ahead and jump to page 10 of 36 of this outline. That's where we will start. 10, actually. And 10 on 36. We left... We handed out a new one that was a revised version of last week's. So if you have last week's, you could throw away page 8 through the rest. And there's copies over here on that table. Before we start on page 10, there is also a question that was asked, I believe, Christopher, or Chris, on page 8. I revised page 8 to include more of the criteria that is useful in making a good inference to the best explanation, because that question came up and I had only a couple there, and I just said there's a lot more, and I just put a few more there on page 8. And that is what people traditionally use to make a judgment on what criteria best suits a hypothesis or a theory when explaining it. Yes, ma'am. 2012? What? On page? Oh, the first page? Oh, yeah, 2012. Yeah, see? I'm so busy here. I'm in last year. Oh, man. That's funny. Okay, so obviously 2013. Okay, so back to page 10, and we'll start there. I'm continuing a little conversation on the page before, which I don't want to go into right now, but I'm basically distinguishing between a design inference and a design argument. And I'll explain that a little bit more later, but that's why it starts off with but, a very unique. Okay, so the idea here is that we're just going to look at this little argument. And these two guys, William Dembski and William Lane Craig, basically put this argument together, not necessarily together, but they seem to both be using it. And again, we're looking at intelligent design, by the way, if you're kind of still out of it. This is the second week we're talking about intelligent design and not looking at any scientific evidence at the moment, but we're just looking at intelligent design as a concept and a way to think about nature. And so these two guys have basically formulated this type of argument, and it says in point one there, the fine-tuning of the universe is due to either physical necessity, chance, or design. So when we're thinking about the cosmos, people talk about it as if it's fine-tuned for life to eventually form. It is not due to physical necessity or chance. So that's premise number two. And premise number three is just the conclusion, actually. It's, therefore, it is due to design. So this is a philosophical argument, and it's got premises and conclusions, and a conclusion, and its soundness is based on the truth or falsity of the premises, which depend on probabilities, which are based in scientific observations and mathematical modeling. So in and of itself, this argument here as laid out is pretty simplistic, and it has theological implications. But those implications are irrelevant to the argument itself. So if you remember back on page one, last time we met, 2 weeks ago, we talked about the two options of the universe, intelligently designed or naturally produced. Those are the two options. And as you can see, everything to the right of those options are implications of those options. They don't have anything to do with the options themselves. It's just what you can draw as an implication from that. And so the same thing is true of this argument. If you conclude that something is designed, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's a Christian God that designed it. It could mean that there's a bunch of gods, or the universe itself is a god or has gods within it, like we talked about with pantheism or panentheism, or aliens came from another region and brought life here. So again, this argument in and of itself is a philosophical argument that has theological implications, but those implications don't relate or influence the argument itself. So why necessity and chance? Why pit those in this sense against design? Well, this is just what happens when you're talking to a naturalist. You get these two ideas, necessity and chance. These are the two options the naturalist employs when explaining the causes and developments of the universe, life, and biological complexity. So mainly we see this in evolution. So when people talk about evolution, they talk about a joint cause of physical necessity and chance acting together. And the way this works is that in evolution, you have chance equating to random mutations in DNA, and Darwin referred to this as just variation. But neo-Darwinism would say that these are based in the DNA strand itself. That's where these random mutations originate from. It's based on that double helix molecule, which we'll talk about next week. Physical necessity, then, would be natural selection. So in the theory of evolution, you have basically three components: natural selection, random variation, random mutation, and the last one, common descent, or universal common descent. And so what the naturalist will do is they'll say that physical necessity and chance together, jointly combined, is all one needs to explain the life that we have here on the planet. Okay? Now, Dembski holds, William Dembski, he is a philosopher and mathematician, and he has been very influential in the intelligent design movement. Dembski holds that this argument is only valid if probabilities are such that the design option is more probable than the physical necessity and chance options. So in other words, we talked a little bit about what criteria is used to make an inference, or the right inference. Dembski says you can add this to the criteria. You could add probability. And probabilities are measured mathematically and statistically in relationship to the scientific observations. And we're going to look at the scientific observations next week, but this week we're going to talk more about the probabilities and the math. Dembski, point H, that is Dembski, is stating that one can, you could cross out make there, one can justifiably make an inference to the best explanation by knowing the probabilities which are based in scientific observations and mathematical modeling. So, for example, design is more probable than chance and physical necessity, therefore is rational to hold to design. So this is kind of the approach Dembski is taking in relationship to the argument here on page 10. So based on probabilities, I would infer one thing over the other. I would infer physical necessity, or infer chance, or infer design, based on probabilities. So if physical necessity is more probable than chance, then I'm going to infer physical necessity. So it's an additional criteria than the ones I just described are on page 8. Any questions about that so far? We're going to talk more about it, but just so far, any questions? Is that an over here? Sorry, I didn't... Oh, okay. G is referring to... Say it again? Yeah, Dembski. Yeah, the argument on page 10. Yeah. Okay, now, point J, how does one detect design? All right, how does one detect design? So if I'm looking at an organism, I come across this strange thing on the beach, let's say, and it's like a jellyfish, lobster, creature thing, and I'm wondering, how did that get there? What is it? What does it consist of? You know, blah, blah, blah. I ask myself all these questions. How would I go about saying that that thing was design or had design influencing its development? Well, William Dembski has been an instrumental in the ID movement, and he's formulated this explanatory filter. So this is kind of like a flowchart. And by following this flowchart, one can detect design. So based on what I input into the flowchart, I'm going to get an output that is either going to be physical necessity, chance, or design. And whatever I put in there will influence the result. So if I put in there something that is operational in nature, then I'm going to get an operational result. If I put in something that's based on origins, I'm going to get an origin result. So we're going to look at that right now. And again, this flow of thought of this filter is very similar to the flow of thought of that argument on page 10. So you could turn the page, and you could see that there's a kind of a flow chart here on page 12. Now, we'll just go straight to the flow chart, and then I'll go through 5 through 8 there. So the question is, how do we detect design? So if you look at the top, it's a start, so that's where you start. And then after that, you immediately hit the question, contingency. Contingency. What is contingency? What does that word mean? Certain conditions? Yeah. What else? Contingency. What is something, what is it to mean that I'm contingent? It's variable. Yeah, right. It's, and another way to phrase it is it's not necessary. It could have been otherwise. It could have been different. It didn't have to be this way. It's contingent. It's based on the conditions, and it could have been another value, for instance. So if I'm saying that something is not contingent, then it's based on out of physical necessity. So it's the item to the right. So you say no, and you go to the right. If it is contingent, then you move down to this question, complexity. Complexity refers to something's improbability. Now, when we think of complexity, we think of something intricate or very well thought out and complicated. But in this sense, it doesn't necessarily mean that. It could mean that, but not necessarily. It more, in this sense, means improbable. Okay? Now, if you go back up, since we're talking about probability, to the word contingency, that is basically not improbable. That means so probable, it's 100% likely to happen. So in other words, if I get hydrogen and two hydrogens and one oxygen together, 100% of the time, I'm going to get water in the right atmospheric conditions. So contingency is necessity, or not contingency is necessity. So that means 100% of the time, I'm going to get this result. It's necessary. It's the necessary outcome. It's physical necessity. That's the idea. Now here, complexity is improbability. So if I'm saying that something is improbable, then I'm saying yes and I can move down. If I'm saying no, it's not improbable, then chance is the option to the right. Okay? So that's, then we have necessity and chance to the right already spelled out. That's how you can get to those options. Now, third on the list is the question specification. Specification has to do with this idea that something is independently patterned. In other words, it has a it has information or some sort of specification in the thing itself. And the idea with this is that it's almost 100% improbable. So as you move down, your improbability increases. As you move down the flow chart, your improbability increases. Once you get to specification, if it passes that test, then it's basically 100% or almost 100% extremely improbable. So 99.99999. And then that's how you can arrive, if you answer yes to that question, at the word design or at the concept of design. If it's not, then you go to the right and it's chance. Now, the whole point of this explanatory filter and the design inference is to differentiate between purely naturalistic causes, unsupplemented by design, and natural causes supplemented by design. So this whole explanatory filter is not meant to show that there is a natural cause or design cause, but it's asking the question, does the natural cause, either an originative cause or operational cause, rely on or require designing intelligence? So the whole point of intelligent design as well is not to say that it's either a natural cause or intelligent design cause, and it's one or the other. It's just to say that if you have a natural cause, does that natural cause have design in it, influencing it, or does the natural cause rely on design or depend on design in any way? That's the whole idea, is that when I arrive at this organism and I'm trying to figure out what it is design a feature of that thing in relationship to its natural development? Okay, so here it's an inference to the best explanation. Again, we talked about that last time. It's abducted reasoning. It's inference to the best explanation. You either get necessity, chance, or design. Which one do you get? It depends on the probabilities. Let's take, for example, a bank safe. Suppose I go into a bank to rob it, and I have a lot of experience with this. You typically, thanks for the courtesy laugh here, second row, A+, gold star. So I got this bank safe, and I'm trying to go in there, and I got this lock combination, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever. And I'm trying to rob this thing, and I have no idea what it is. So I just go in there and start trying stuff. And suppose it has 10 numbers I have to put in sequentially. Okay, so there's an order. I have to go to 3, and then to 8, and then back to 4, whatever. and there's 10 of them. And if I don't get all 10 of them right, then I'm not getting in the safe. Well, the idea here is that the improbability of me getting in that safe is extremely high. So we would call that complexity, because it's improbability. So think of complexity again as improbability. Now, suppose I had my whole life to stand in front of this thing and turn that knob and just waste my life away doing that. And suppose I just never moved and I just kept cranking at it and I die at like 90 or whatever. Well, the chances are, because it has 10 in a row required numbers to get in, and I have, say, I don't know, 10 to the, I don't know, let's say 100th power of opportunities, the probability of me getting in that is 10 times 10 to the 100th power. So that's, based on how I remember things, 10 to the 1,000th probability equals. Sorry? 101? Okay. 100 first. It's been a while.
That's a much larger number than... Yeah.
And I'm an engineer. So we don't deal with probabilities too much. Sorry for the bad handwriting, but you get the idea. Is that the way to spell this out mathematically is probability equals M times N times, I believe, N. So this is the opportunities. No, this is the opportunities. This is the resources, which means the numbers. And actually, I think that's just that, the opportunities and the resources. So the whole point of that is just that I can arrive at a calculation of probability. And what happens is, depending on how complex it is, the 10 digits here, that number then increases this number, my probability. Or the way it's actually worded is the 1 over P. So this is, probability is this, 1 divided by that. So I have a 1 chance in this many to get that number. That's how you calculate this. And I believe then this is 1 over all of that. That's basically the idea. So of 1 chance and all of that and all of this many probabilistic resources to open that safe. And we're speaking conceptually here, but I'm trying to just give you the idea, because this is very important when understanding chance, necessity, and design. So again, crude example, but that's the point of it, is that the higher the improbability, the less of a chance that I can actually enter the safe. So to say that something is based on chance is very hard to do when the improbabilities are so high. So if something is extremely improbable, then it's less likely that chance caused it. Or in other words, one shouldn't infer chance if something is extremely improbable. How improbable? We'll talk about that in a second. So the inference to design on page 13, the inference to design is validated based on the probabilities and specified information found in the object or event. So it depends on what we're talking about. That will determine the probability. That is, something can be said to be designed if it exhibits what we're calling specified complexity. Specified complexity is different than the concept that you may have heard before, known as irreducible complexity, that we will talk about later. This is different than that. This is specified complexity. So again, it's independently patterned, which is specified, and highly improbable, complex. So if an observer detects specified complexity, the organism or universe is inferred as designed. So if I find something, now I've tried to demonstrate what is something that we can call complexity, but if I add to complexity this idea of specified that there's an independently patterned something, information, we can say, then with these two combined, I can say that I can infer that something is designed. So if an observer detects specified complexity, the organism or universe is inferred as design. And again, it's not just that something, that the phenomena are highly or even extremely improbable complexity, but it is the fact that the event conforms to an independently patterned specific, which can be thought of as specified complexity. So I'm just trying to demonstrate what these words are. It has to be both. It can't just be complex, because I can say that I got in that safe based on chance. If I just give me enough time, give me enough opportunities, I'll get in there. It may take me, you know, a trillion years, but I'll get in there. And I can't say that it was designed. It was based on chance that I got in there. But if I go in there and open it up the first time, then I'm talking about information being involved, specification. I have some independently patterned something that I'm using to get in there. So something that is highly improbable for me to do, if I go in there on the first time and do it, then I have both of these things combining together, and that's what we're calling specified complexity. And then someone could say, you knew the code. You knew how to get in that safe. You got in there the first time. You took something that was extremely improbable. The chances of somebody getting there was this low, and you got in there the first time. So someone is right in inferring design, or inferring that I knew the code. That is a logical inference. It wouldn't be based on chance. Now, point 14. Specifications are epistemically objective, and complexity is ontologically objective. We don't have to talk about that, but it's just to give some of us amongst us a little food for thought. Now, similarly, we can think of a bridge card game. Who plays bridge here? Anybody? Okay, let's say poker. Let's use the word poker. Okay, let's think of a poker game. And someone deals out a royal flush, first hand. You sit at the table, dealer gives you a royal flush, all spades. Okay, let's think of that in our mind. A perfect bridge hand, or a perfect poker hand, let's say, is a royal flush. And it's different from a random bridge hand, let's say, Jack, ace, two, five, and all different suits, right? They're called suits. Heart, spades, diamonds. A perfect hand is different than a random bridge hand in that it has special traits which makes its occurrence surprising and improbable. Okay? It has special traits which makes its occurrence surprising and improbable. That is, a perfect bridge hand, or let's say a royal flush, has special traits due to the independent previously formed rules of the game, and one could, before or after, detect design, a rigged deal of the cards. So based on what we know about what is a royal flush, what comprises a royal flush, if I was to get that very improbable hand the first try, one would say that was a rigged deal. And that would be, again, a logical inference. Both the improbability and the specification of the perfect bridge hand reveal a rigged deal, a designed deal of the cards. So when you get something improbable and it's specified, then a rigged deal is logically inferred. Now, again, it's different than just a random deal. You could say, well, a random deal of cards is, you know, 2, 7, Jack, whatever, and that's improbable. And I agree, and so is a royal flush. It's improbable. But when you add the idea of specified to it, then you get something that is logically inferred as rigged, specified complexity. Yes?
Probability, but if a specific just its appearance as a sequence, the independent variable doesn't have a point, and then the probability becomes a hypothetical.
Yeah,
point. Are you saying reason, purpose? Or are you saying point like a point?
That's what, yeah, I have the same question. Do you mean purpose, or do you mean just specification?
I'm just trying to follow the question.
Yeah, it has like a specific...
meaning?
I guess meaning.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not necessarily. You could say weight. Yeah, not necessarily meaning, but there's something... the term is just... we don't want to move too far from this term, specification. It's very important that we just use that, because we're trying to create a minimal criteria for detecting design. If then we add meaning to it, which it also has, some things won't have meaning, but they can also be designed because they'll have these two. Yeah.
The thing about a deck of cards is, like, okay, if I were to take a deck of cards and shuffle it, and the state that it's in after I've shuffled is completely random, that order, that stack, has never occurred in the history of ever. But if I were to shuffle it and get, and then thumb through it and find a royal flush, the chances of me having a royal flush in a stack of shuffled cards is thousands of times more likely than the random state that I just created by shuffling a deck of cards. Because, but the completely random state of shuffled cards is so much more unlikely to have occurred than anything else possible.
Well, because no. That's 52 cards and the other thing is only 5. So of course we've got all play
how
many cards.
No, when I shuffle, if I shuffle a deck of cards and then just lay it flat on the table, I have thousands and thousands of opportunities to have a royal flush. 5 cards in the correct order. First of all, I've got 4 times because I've got hearts, diamonds, clubs, and spades. And then I've got all these different positions that it can occur in the deck. But when I just take a deck and shuffle it, and it's random, and the state that I've set it down in, that order is far more significant. And because it has never occurred, ever, even though the flush that we're talking about, which seems like it's this, the chances of me dealing out a royal flush off the top of a randomly shuffled deck of cards seems so improbable. It's far more mathematically improbable just to shuffle the cards and have that occur.
Okay, so if I understand correctly, you're saying that if I shuffle some cards and I don't deal them, but we just happen to figure out...
Lay them flat out,
and in order...
never occurred in the history of the universe.
In order, you're saying that the royal flush, if it was in order right there, you're saying that's never occurred in the history of the universe.
No, if you just shuffle the deck of cards,
yep,
set it down, that order has never occurred.
You're saying all 52 cards.
The order of the cards. Okay.
That order has never occurred.
Okay. Okay, and?
But to shuffle a deck of cards and then lay it out, and that order, which has never occurred, but then to find a royal flush in there,
mm-hmm,
has thousands of opportunities to occur. Well, you've got 52 positions,
yeah,
minus 5, so 47 possible positions that the royal flush could occur if you're not considering a wraparound, and then you've got that times 4, so you've got approximately 200 possible,
mm-hmm,
that a royal flush could occur 200 times more likely than shuffling a deck of cards and having that state.
Yeah. Yeah, so...
It just, we apply, yeah, we for some reason think of that as something more interesting, even though it's far more powerful.
Yeah. Okay. Now, what you just described, is that, where are you going with that? Tell me, is that all that you're trying to say with just right there, or is that...
Yeah, well, you're just talking about the, like, what are the chances of getting a royal flush.
What are the chances?
And I'm saying far less likely than me shuffling a deck of cards and having that happen.
Okay, okay. So you're just comparing something that is improbable with something that is even more improbable.
But every time I shuffle a deck of cards,
yep,
that improbable thing happens.
Yeah, but it only matters so you shuffle it, you got your 52 cards, and then you want to shuffle it again, what's the chances of getting the same one again, right? Is that what you're...
What I'm saying is when I shuffle it, what occurs has never occurred before. Each arrangement, every time you shuffle a deck of cards, it has never happened.
But it's just your chance, so who cares?
But I'm saying that you're describing something that's unlikely.
Yes.
And I'm saying it's really not that unlikely.
Okay, see, that's...
It's all relative, and it's it's actually far more likely than everything I do every single day.
Okay. So I get where you're going with that now. So, yeah, if something is improbable and specified, we can infer design, like we talked about. Now, you're just saying that, wait a minute, the analogy that I'm using as a royal flush, and I'm saying that's improbable, you're saying actually that could be probable depending on circumstances, type of dealing, probable. Is that what you're saying?
It's not probable.
Okay, it's not probable. So you're agreeing that it's improbable?
No.
No. Okay. Well, let's push pause on that and let's talk about the break, because I'm not sure if I understand fully, but I want to, and I want to make sure me and you understand. But the idea of, if nothing else, is the analogy is just trying to serve, of the card game, is just trying to serve this concept of something being improbable and specified. And the card game is a way to do that, because there's improbability involved, but there's also specification involved too. So it may not even be a perfect analogy, but it's not necessarily trying to. It's just trying to reveal this concept. Now, I think we'd all agree that a deal on the first try of a royal flush is improbable. Now, it could happen easily, just by chance. But the point is, what are the chances? What is the probability of that happening? And so you have 52 cards, and so there's a way to calculate the probability or improbability. So so that's kind of the idea with that whole card game analogy. It's just straightforward to reveal a concept. And I appreciate your question, too. So thank you both for the questions. But if we can, let's talk more about that at the break, because I just really want to make sure I understand you. But does everybody understand the card game analogy just as a concept? Okay. In summary, we can see that if something is both specified and highly improbable, it is designed. And this idea of specified complexity isn't really new to William Dembski. It first originated in the 1970s from British chemist Leslie Orgel, and who it was also revisited by cosmologist and author Paul Davies in 1999. But Dembski and Meyer have been instrumental in establishing it as a method for detecting design. And this next little conversation in point 20 on into page 16 is just further elaboration on the concept of specified complexity. So I would really like you to read that on your own time, and especially item 3, where it talks about probabilistic resources and this idea of, oh, there's that equation. If you look on page 16, there it is. At the top of page 16 in item 6, P is M times N times P, and that's the probability that chance produced the event, where M and P are the specificational resources, and N is the probability that this event actually occurs with one opportunity. And then it's multiplied by P. And, so P, I can't remember exactly how that goes, but there's a nice calculation, I just don't remember the terms. But it's not very important. It's just that when you have opportunities to do something, the more opportunities you have, the more then you multiply it by the number of probabilistic resources, and then your probability will grow. So the more chances I have to open the safe, the more probable I'm going to open that safe. If I get to, say, the 1 trillionth try, and I've already tried a bunch of stuff, and it doesn't work, well, then I've only got a few more combinations left to go. So it's more probable that I'm going to get in after the trillionth try. So that's the idea of probabilistic resources. The more probabilistic resources I have at my disposal, time, energy to turn it, that sort of thing, the more chances I have I'm going to get in this. My probability increases. The less chance I have, maybe just one shot or one deal of the cards, for instance, and I get that royal flush or I get that combination, then I can obviously say that was a very improbable event. But it happened, let's say. Okay, so let's go down to point K, or item K there. Again, this above discussion in point 20 was just to further elaborate on the concept of specified complexity. How does one rule out physical necessity? So if you look at the flowchart, physical necessity is kind of the first option to the right when you have this concept of contingency. And we're going to look at physical necessity in each area of the science we're going to cover, astrophysics, biochemistry, in the few weeks to come. But for now, I just want to make a couple points on page 17. The point that I want to make, and then we'll take a break, is just simply this. Without even reading this, I'll just explain it the best I can. If I was to have the unfolding of the universe occur right in front of me, or the unfolding of an organism, or the development of an organism, someone who's a naturalist may say, well, that organism or that universe developed naturally, or it organized naturally. And so they would say, well, that explanatory filter is whack. You know, there's criticisms that we'll get to. But I want to make the point that just because something, if you grant that something organizes naturally or develops naturally, you're not granting the point that order was in the object or in the universe, or specification was in the universe or the organism. Order is something of it's kind of like an abstract entity. It's something that nature presupposes when it moves something forward. So as the universe developed or organized itself, it presupposes this concept of order. It requires order to be there existing before that order is, you could say, bestowed upon it. Or it's a transmission of order from one type of a formation of matter and energy to another type of formation of matter and energy. So order is not something that's in the object itself, the universe or the organism. The universe or organism uses order and exemplifies order as it unfolds. And so what happens is the physical or the naturalist will say that nature itself, they like to think of it as something that's self-caused or self-developed, meaning that it didn't require design or any supernatural intervention. But right here we see immediate problem is that order itself is a concept that nature uses. And we can see the transmission or the development from one stage of the universe in its embryonic form. Consider the Big Bang, for instance, in this tiny singularity, if it originated that way, and the very next stage, we have further development. That transmission of development of matter and energy that is transmitted from one stage to another requires order, and order is not in the object itself. And the physicalness or the naturalist will try to say that this development or organization that we see unfold is order. It equates to order. It's the same thing as order. And they try to make that move, but we need to distinguish between those things. So next week we're going to talk about, or in a couple weeks, how the origins of life, the physicalness, the naturalist will say that within the chemicals themselves, at the early stage of the earth, you have this prebiotic soup, if you will, with some sort of molecules floating around, and they have inherent in themselves properties that attract themselves to each other, and they are like magnets. They form together, and these amino acids formed and reacted with each other and formed the original proteins. And then from that, there's this development of life. And so that's where the naturalist will try to go. And so I'm just trying to make the distinguishing point here that we need to differentiate between this idea of order in and of itself, like love or number or a color, something that exists that we know it but is not necessarily in the thing, and how the naturalist will try to say that that thing is order, or order is part of that object's essence. Any questions on that? And we'll take a break. Hopefully that made sense. Questions on that? Okay, so we'll again look at how do you rule out physical necessity depending on if you're talking about the universe, depending on if you're talking about an organism. We'll look at that as we come to it. All right, why don't we take a break for 5 minutes, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about ruling out chance. Now, we just talked a little bit about how to rule out physical necessity, even though we didn't talk about it, but we went over that topic, and we're going to talk about that specifically when we get into astrophysics and biochemistry. But we just tried to make that distinction between order not in the thing and order in the thing. Okay, so now chance. Talk about chance. In this explanatory filter, we have the three options: physical necessity, chance, and design. So how does one rule out chance? Okay, well, we ask the question, how small of a probability does it take to rule out chance? So if I say something is 5% likely to occur, is that small enough to rule out chance? Okay, probably not, because that's improbable, but not that improbable. Or we could ask, how improbable must something be for chance not to be inferred? So, if I say that something has a probability less than 10 to the 20th power, is that sufficient to rule out chance? What about 10 to the 30th power? Is that sufficient? What about 10 to the 40th? Is that sufficient? How low of a probability must something be for chance to be ruled out? So let's say that Steve right now starts shooting lasers out of his eyes, for instance. Okay. Yeah, he does it every day. Superman, Cyclops. Okay, and Mark, for instance, he starts shooting spider webs out of his wrist, for instance. Let's just say these guys are doing that at the same time for some strange reason. They feel like this room requires a superhero. Yeah, and so the probability of him shooting laser beams out of his eye are probably 1 out of, say, 10 to the 50th power. Very, very low probability that that's going to happen. And the probability of him shooting spider webs out of his wrist is probably 10 to the 60th power. Now, what is the probability of those things happening at the same time, at the same place, in the same room? Well, what you do is you multiply those probabilities. 10 to the 50th and 10 to the 60th, and you get 10 to the 110th. You add the numerator, not the numerator, the exponent. So now, let's talk about Dembski. He says that, or he basically calculated the most conservative universal probability bound in literature at 10 to the 150th power. Okay, and the way he calculated that is he said that 10 to the 80th power is the number of elementary particles in the universe. Okay, so he's calculating the number of elementary particles in the universe. Then he's calculating 10 to the 45th power is the fastest possible transition rate of matter, which is equal to the number of transitions per second. Okay, so that's how fast matter can transition from one thing to another per second. And then he's calculating the age of the universe. Okay, so a lot of people think the age of the universe is like, I think 14 billion years old or something like that. 10 to the 25th power, that's the number of seconds that 14 billion years is. So he calculates the total number of specified events is less than all of these numbers combined, which is 10 to the 80th, 10 to the 45th, 10 to the 25th, and that's 10 to the 150th power. That's the total number of specified events in the universe. Now, I'm summarizing him on this, so you have to just bear with me that if you read his books, you can kind of get a better sense of what's happening here. But the idea is that 1 out of 10 to 150th power is the universal probability bound. And that represents the probability of the events occurring when including all of the relevant probabilistic resources that could aid in its occurrence. So if I get together all of the probabilistic resources in the entire universe to help Steve shoot lasers out of his eyes and help Mark shoot spiderwebs out of his wrist and help them do it at the same time, then I'm helping them. I'm giving them probabilistic resources to do that. Time, energy, materials, mutations, watching X-Men videos, whatever, to aid them in doing that. That's the idea. So something very improbable can become more probable where chance can be said to produce it with all the relevant probabilistic resources. So if I give them everything they need and help them, then that something that was once very improbable can become more probable because I'm giving them probabilistic resources. It may also remain improbable. So in this sense, chance can't be said to produce it even with all the probabilistic resources. Now, and since our universe has a finite past, we're saying that let's take the standard Big Bang model, for instance, and let's say it comes from a singularity, and we can measure that singularity based on the expansion of the universe and so forth, and we have a finite universe in terms of time and space, there is a limited amount of probabilistic resources available in the universe. From since time began till now, we have only some set number of probabilistic resources, just say 50 bazillion, trillion, million, whatever, some number. Those are the amount of probabilistic resources we have in this finite universe we live in. So if an event has a probability 1 in 10 to the 150th power, its occurrence will remain improbable even with all the probabilistic universes, even with all of the universe's probabilistic resources. So that means that if something has probability P, and that probability P is less than 10 to the 150th power, then even with all the universe's probabilistic resources brought in, it's still not going to happen. Okay, here's a couple quotes. Go to 9. Implicit in a universal probability bound, such as 1 in 10 to the 150th power, is that the universe is too small a place to generate specified complexity by sheer exhaustion of possibilities. So perhaps I can illustrate it by drawing just a simple line. And I know this isn't what you'd typically expect, and maybe in an apologetics class, I don't know, but let's say that in terms of probabilities or chances, 10 to the 150th is right here. Okay? And this is a probability 0, and this is probability 1, and this is, say, a logarithmic scale, and say 10 to the 20th is here, 10 to the 50th is here, and say 10 to the 100th is here, and say 10 to the 200 is here, and again, logarithmic 500, so it's changes quickly. So if I'm saying that there's a probability, let's just say it's probable that Steve shoots laser beams out of his eye is here, Steve's lasers. Okay. There's a 10 to the, say, 30th power, or before I use 50th, let's say 10 to the 30th power, he does that. And Mark, it was 10 to the 60th, so this is Mark's webs. That's there. Well, you kind of get the idea. The smaller probability you have, the less likely that thing's going to occur. And so what Dembski is saying is this 10 to 150th power represents the universal probability bound. Anything beyond this line, he's saying that if something is less probable than that, then chance cannot be inferred. Because you're taking all of the probabilistic resources that the universe has to offer from since time began, you're bringing them to bear on that occurrence or event or organism or something, and you're seeing if all of the events combined could have produced something. And if that probability that you arrive at, that P number that you calculate, happens to be here, then this is beyond what chance could have done. Because the universe has a finite past, and there's not enough time, resources, materials, energy, whatever, to take place, that it could have happened from now till since time began. So this is where you have to infer its specified complexity. When you get beyond the universal probability bound. If you're on the right side, or if you have a greater probability than the universal probability bound, then chance could be inferred. But beyond that, chance can't be inferred, because there's not enough probabilistic resources in the universe. Now, suppose you have an event that is here, or an occurrence of something that is there. On this side, or greater than 10 to the 150th power. Suppose you're here, like that. Let's say aminos turn to enzymes. Let's say at the earliest stages of life's formation in the prebiotic soup of early Earth. And energy zapped the soup, and there was a bunch of molecules floating around, and that happened. Well, Fred Hoyle, he suggests the chances, the probability of that happening is P equal to 1 in the 10 to the 40,000th power. That's what he calculated for that to occur. Now, here we're at 10 to the 500th. That's way past the universal probability bound. So what Dembski is saying is that if something is that low in terms of its improbability, or something is that low in terms of its probability, it's so improbable, that chance cannot be said to produce it. That's what Dembski is saying. So here, you can say chance could have caused it. And here you're saying that it was designed. That is what the explanatory filter is trying to do. Now, back to the outline. If that is, in point 10, if probability of something occurring is smaller than the limit, then chance could not be inferred, as its improbability is beyond the limit of the actual possibilities in the universe. So specified complexity indicates that an event corresponding to the specified pattern has a probability less than the universal probability bound of 10 to the 150th power. That is, probability is so low that chance is ruled out, which is just what we were saying. So it is not necessary that probability be below this lower limit, but if it is, it is sufficient to assert that specified complexity and definitely sufficient to rule out chance. Before I go further, I want to just correct something. I put this green line here, sorry, that I meant to put like right there. That's 10 to the 40,000th powers way out here. This is the idea that Dembski is presenting. And the last point I just made was that what if something is actually here? Could it still be designed? Yes, it could. Because it's still specified and highly improbable. Because this, again, is the idea is that probability is decreasing. So
this one is still designed.
Yeah, like if I design and build a chair, the chances of me, or the fact that I designed it and built it, is 100% chance. But so the idea with this graph is just that improbability increases as you go that way. Probability increases as you go that way. To help you demonstrate that. Now, if something occurs here, could it still be thought of to be designed? Yes. But Dembski's just saying that if it's past this limit, then chance is ruled out. It cannot be chance because it's too low. It's beyond the possibilities of the universe based on the probabilistic resources available. That's what Dembski's saying past this point. And it still could be, say I calculate its probability and it's 10 to the 90th power, it still could be thought of as designed because it's still improbable. And again, if you remember the criteria as specified complexity, complexity being improbability, improbability is still here. I'm still very improbable when I'm at this point. So this is kind of the idea with how you rule out chance. And to rule it out completely, it has to go beyond this. Something now is debatable in this case. Well, it's that improbable, so chance or design could have caused it because it's just extremely improbable. It's not that improbable, but it's that improbable. So then how do we know if it's there, if it's designed or not? Well, if it's this improbable and it's specified, then we say it's designed. This is just the probability spectrum, not the specification spectrum. If I add in the concept of specification to it, then I have something that's designed. Questions? Yes, sir.
You have P equaling that number.
40,000.
Where does that number come from?
Fred Hoyle calculated it. I don't know. I didn't figure out how he calculated it.
Because, I mean, some other people would maybe contest the difference.
Oh, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, so say amino, and again, I'm just asserting the concept. I'm not talking about this particular science here, which is what I'm hopefully going to get into next week or the next week after. Did life originate on the planet based on natural causes alone? Did amino acids turn into enzymes or turn into more complex molecules forming the cell? Possibly. Now, what later on I'll present is evidence that'll show that no, that never happened. And basically, Fred Hoyle, Walter Bradley, and Michigan State professor, three different experiments that lasted decades each in the last 50 years, from the 70s, 90s, and now, has shown that this didn't occur. Now, I'm just going to briefly cross over that evidence, though, in a couple weeks. We're not going to spend a lot of time because it's just something that I'm pulling out of that. And then others who will argue that this did actually... I'm not even sure if they argue this. Usually the argument is, do more simple chemicals form amino acids? That's usually what people are doing in the lab. Does something turn into amino acids? Not necessarily does aminos turn into enzymes, because that's basically been ruled out, or that's been not shown experimentally, that this, because this is the huge jump. the thing before it is not much of a jump. Something going to aminos is like, I can't remember what it was, but some chemical, 10 to the 25th power. That's the chance of some these other chemicals to turn into aminos, 10 to the 25th power. Okay, then aminos to turn into enzymes is much bigger. It's just astronomically bigger chance than this. Than the smaller molecules turning into amino acids. And again, I haven't. I'm just asserting it for the sake of the concept. But we haven't discussed the science itself. So yeah, we'll hopefully get to that. But I mean, I'm not going to debate one way or other. It's just that certain scientists are doing certain experiments and they're coming up with certain measurements. Yeah. Yes, sir. Yeah.
How would you describe or attribute that?
That's a good question. So say life arises on Mars.
Right.
Well, not life. Let's not say that. Let's just say amino acids. Okay, the point is that enzymes are not life. Cells maybe could be thought of as life. Okay. Yeah, a bacteria,
or
right?
Prion.
A what?
Prion.
Prion? Okay, right. So either of those could be thought of, the later ones, maybe a cell, maybe bacteria, as life. Maybe we could categorize like that. But that's a good point. If that is found, then that is interesting, for sure. And if that is something that could be experimentally developed in the lab, then that is interesting, too. But the issues that have plagued naturalists or evolutionists over the years is this formation. This simple stuff, chemicals to amino acids to enzymes, and not seeing it very well, if at all, in the lab experiments. And I'm being generous there. I mean, it's very hard to show this. There's been basically zero evidence, maybe nil, to show this development. And we're kind of jumping ahead here. I didn't want to get into this, but I'm just trying to use that as an example. But one of the things we will try to talk about is, in maybe 5 minutes, we'll try to bring that up, which we already have done just now. So these little lab experiments I just mentioned. I can't remember the name. Miller-Urey. Miller-Urey experiments, if you're interested in doing more research on this, talking about this whole idea of self-organizing stuff. Miller-Urey, you can kind of Google that. That's just one little minute point in the whole grand scheme of things. But because we're talking about the universe, we're talking about organisms, we're talking about everything with this whole concept. It's this general concept of chance versus design versus necessity. And as I've mentioned before, we're not trying to say that it's design is all there is to it. Poof, there's just the human. We're just trying to say is design involved or relied on in any way by a natural process? Grant evolution, grant singularity, Big Bang, grant all those things. Is design involved in that natural process? We can grant that as Christians, fine. We can grant that. But the question is now, in terms of intelligent design or in the explanatory filter, is design relied on or dependent on in any way by the natural process? Or is it only natural with nothing else involved? Okay. We're going to skip page 20 and go to 21. But is there any other questions on that? Okay. All right. Page 21. Now, the criticisms of the explanatory filter have been put forward to show that it is an unreliable method of detecting design. So people just don't agree that this is a good approach. They say, hey, your approach sucks. So criticism number one is that the filter doesn't account for the joint action of chance and necessity as in the Darwinian mechanism. While the response to that criticism is that the necessity node can be thought to be chance at 100% probability. Thus, the filter does account for joint action of chance and necessity as 100% chance. So the criticism says, well, wait a minute. You say necessity and chance, but evolutionary theory involves both necessity and chance together, combined. It's a joint action, like we talked about earlier. Well, what Dembski is saying, no, necessity is chance at unity, at the one. This is necessity. That's what Dembski says. So he is, in a sense, accounting for the joint action of chance and necessity because he says, this is necessity. This is 100% chance something is going to happen. 100% chance is one. So he's basically trying to say, no, you can't use that criticism because it does include the joint action of both. So criticism number two, the filter will incorrectly yield design to that which is merely improbable or geometric or self-organizing. So the critic is saying that if you go into this explanatory filter, this flowchart, you're going to get design for something that is, quote, self-organizing, kind of like this whole idea with these amino acids, or just something that's merely improbable. And the response is that it's simply not true, as the improbable alone will yield chance. The geometric and self-organizing will yield physical necessity. So it does account for this idea that the critic doesn't think it does account for. So the point is that one just needs to have differentiated input when approaching the filter. I don't want to get into all of these criticisms too much, but if one approaches the filter with a certain input, say operational input, you're going to get an operational output. If someone approaches the filter with an origin input, you're going to get an origin output. So I can say, let's say Steve's glasses, use Steve again as an example, are those glasses designed or how did they originate? So I'm inputting origination at the top and I'm going to have the result be they originated based on design. If I talk about how did Steve's glasses develop, so operational, they developed based off of design. There was a process someone developed and it went through this process and output, you get glasses, designed glasses as an output. So again, if you go in with inputs as operations or origins, you're going to get output as operations or origins. So we have to keep that in mind with the filter because that could be easily misunderstood. And that's what the rest of this is saying. I'm talking about Fibonacci sequences, which is something that it could be found in nature in certain organisms. They displace this idea of a spiral that goes out like this, and every step along the spiral is twice the previous step, and mathematically it's expressed very eloquently in this idea called Fibonacci sequence. And I can't remember what it is, but it's like
1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13.
Yeah, kind of like that, but the nomenclature is something to do with like n plus 1 times n. I can't remember the formula for it, but it's very eloquent.
N is equal to n plus n.
No, there's other notation. But yeah, that's the idea. And the idea is things like this are found in nature. So if it's natural, then the critic says, well, then this you're going to say is design, but it's just natural. So your explanatory filter doesn't show that it's natural. It's physical necessity. You're going to say it's design based on your filter. And so the response is that, no, you have to input you have to go into the filter with the input of operation or the input of origin as a question, and then you could come out with the right answer. So you could say, what caused the Fibonacci sequence could be natural, like how it came from that organism. Because this is kind of like a flower, I think. In nature, you could find it. It looks like this. And but what? How did the Fibonacci sequence originate? Then you go into the filter. Then you come out with the filter as the Fibonacci sequence originated as designed. So that's the idea. What you go in with as origin or operational, you come out with. Okay, and then criticism number three, we're going to skip. It's quite intriguing. I'm sure you'll enjoy it on your own time. And then in general, and we'll end with this in about 10 minutes, we'll just cover this and we'll end. Page 24, item M. Frequently we get a criticism of the design inference. Critics will say that this is just appealing to a god of the gaps. You may have heard that before, the god of the gaps. And so what does that mean? Well, there are some unknowns of science. We'll call them gaps in our collective knowledge as a human race that require further explanation to arrive at a holistic understanding of that field of science. So this is what the naturalist says, who accuses the design theorist as saying, you're just appealing to the god of the gaps. And they say that these unknowns, these gaps in our knowledge, are like many unknowns of the past that we eventually resolved. For instance, earthquakes were not caused by the gods being mad, or eclipses didn't require howling at the moon to be completed for the eclipse to be finished, or sacrificing to fertility gods didn't matter for good or bad rain for crops that year. We've figured this out, that we don't have to sacrifice to the fertility gods, and the rain will do what it does. So that is, by attributing causal power to a god, we were ignorant as a human race before. But now that we are educated and developed, there is no need to appeal to a deity for explanations of reality that we are currently ignorant of. So there's some things that we just don't know. We have gaps in our knowledge as a human race. The naturalist will claim that this is what the ID theorists and scientists are doing. They accuse ID proponents of introducing God to cover their ignorance when they should be doing real science that does not appeal to a non-scientific entity when examining the gaps of human knowledge. So this is what ID theorists are accused of, the God of the gaps. And the naturalist will claim that this is just laziness on their part. So whoever is an ID scientist is just being lazy by appealing to the God of the gaps. They're not really trying to investigate the natural cause. So that's the naturalist strategy, is to cast out scientists who they accuse as those who resort to include God as an explanation of what is not yet explained. Eventually we'll figure it out. Just like we figured out there's no fertility gods and earthquakes aren't caused by God being mad. Eventually we'll figure it out and we'll close those gaps in our knowledge. Well, Eugenie Scott, the executive director of the National Center for Science Education, stated that scientists don't agree on how life began yet, and yet is a very important word in science. One should not assume that just because something is not currently understood, that it will never be understood. And the ID proponent suggests that because some models of natural origin of life have been disproved, we must give up our search and seek a supernatural explanation. So this is what Eugenie Scott, a naturalist, a secular person, is saying that the ID proponent is doing. They're just giving up the search and saying a supernatural cause did it. Who cares? We don't care anymore about science. It's kind of what she's referring to here. And so what she's doing, and other naturalists do, they frame the issue with this narrative. And on the next page you could see kind of this idea of how they frame the debate. They say that to answer the question of how to explain gaps in science, the naturalist says this is how it goes. Well, we either explain gaps now with God or future science to explain gaps. So it's either we explain them now, we use God to figure it out, or the naturalist says, well, we're not sure, but later we'll figure it out. Future science versus God now. Or they phrase it out, how to explain complexity in nature. And they explain complexity, they say that we explain complexity now with God, and future science to explain complexity is what they do. So that's how they frame the debate. And this is how they basically try to cast out those who are ID proponents, or even just critics of evolution. They will say, oh, well, you're criticizing evolution. Well, okay, then obviously you don't want to figure this out yourself. You don't want to spend the time to look for a natural cause, so we're going to give you some trouble. We don't have to get into that right now, but the response of the ID proponent, there's two types of responses to that, and we'll finish this up. ID proponent will either... the ID proponents who imply God as the intelligent designer will respond one way, and other people that don't imply God as the intelligent designer respond a different way. So there's two types of responses. First, if we take the response from the ID proponent who implies God as the intelligent designer, they say they're making an inference, not filling a gap in terms of our knowledge. And so this is what is not happening, is what they're saying. The ID proponent is not throwing up their hands and saying, I don't know, God must have done it. They're saying that's not what's happening. What the ID proponent is actually doing is making an inference to the best explanation. ID proponents do what archaeologists, forensic detectives, and Darwin did. Given E1, E2, these are evidences that we talked about last time, E3, E4, E5, etc., what best H, hypothesis 1 to hypothesis N, for instance, say 17, best explains them when the criteria is applied? Then the inference to the best explanation can be made, like we've talked about. And so the ID theorist will reject the above narrative as presented by the naturalist and restate it as follows. In terms of the question how to explain knowledge and lack of knowledge in each field, both knowledge and gaps in our knowledge, we can explain this, again, as God is the best basis of all explanation. So again, this is the idea or the response from the ID critic who says that God is implied by intelligent design. So if you look here, you can see that you have, say, different fields of knowledge, science with its gaps, philosophy with its gaps, other fields, morality. All of these fields of knowledge with their gaps, and what the design theorist will say, or a type of response, is that the best explanation to explain all of these fields of knowledge is God is the basis for all E, the fields of knowledge, E being each field. So God here is the conclusion after the investigation of what explains rationality for all fields of knowledge. God is not presupposed or assumed here as a starting point. He's the conclusion. So when we go looking for answers of what best explains E1 through E6, let's say E's are just fields of knowledge, we can look at all these different hypotheses and we could say that God is the best explanation. He's the one that best explains them, how we arrive at fields of knowledge in general, even with their gaps. We can understand God explains how we know the content of those fields and all the fields, and he's the basis of explanation of our rationality. And gaps are just part of those fields. They're included. So it's not that he's plugging in the gaps with God. He's saying God is the basis of all explanation itself, explanation itself, rationality itself, so that we can understand the content of each respective field. Whereas, let's say, H5, we'll call that naturalism, doesn't have the resources to explain all of these fields of knowledge. We talked about the criticisms of naturalisms before, and the list of unexplained features of the universe and human existence, and how naturalism doesn't account for those things. And so, for instance, like wonder and amazement about the universe is basically, according to the naturalist, equivalent to boredom. Because at the end of the day, all of those so-called experiences are just a bunch of neurons firing the head, where I say, look at the universe and say, wow, look at that, that's amazing. Well, that's the same thing as looking at the universe and saying, wow, that's really boring. You know, and it's just the same thing. There's no way to articulate meaning for the naturalist because they don't have a basis that explains meaning, whereas the ID proponent at least does. God is the basis that explains meaning. And another example, we've talked about the features of human existence before, but say suffering of children from disease. You know, how does the naturalist explain that as being sad or unjust or wrong? Instead of just what happens. This is just what happens. Natural things just cause children to have disease. And so what is being compared here is the naturalist worldview and the Christian worldview. What best explains this natural phenomena? Is it that, or how we understand it? How can we make sense of it? Rationally speaking, is it God or is it nature? And so what the ID proponent says is that God is the best explanation in terms of explaining these features of human existence. And in that sense, item 8, God is not an alternative to scientific explanation, but is the foundation for all explanation and makes explanation itself possible. So that includes scientific explanation. And the way to think about this is if you consider Henry Ford and the engine and the assembly line, he's the mind behind the mechanism of the internal combustion engine. He designed it, basically brought it to fruition. Now, we have gaps. My wife doesn't really care what's under the hood. She never will, probably. And she just wants the car to get her from point A to point B. And she's a happy camper, and she just wants it to work. And so she may not even understand it. Like, I ask her questions like, do you know what a piston is? Or do you know what a cylinder is? And she just doesn't care, doesn't want to talk about it, has no clue. And she may not understand it. So we could say that's a gap in her knowledge. But that doesn't mean that it's not... Let me just read this instead of saying that. The naturalists state that when we do not understand the physics, the ID proponent is not permitted to invoke Henry Ford as the designer of the car engine. So my wife may know that Henry Ford designed the car. And just because she doesn't understand the physics, the naturalist says that she's not allowed to invoke Henry Ford as the designer. No, she knows Henry Ford designed it. And she knows he designed the assembly line and brought it all out, built the company, whatever. But the naturalist says, just because you don't design it, or because you don't understand it, you can't invoke Henry Ford. That's what the naturalist says to the ID proponent, which is not fair, because that's not what we're doing anyway, but that's just not realistic. Because just because we don't understand something doesn't mean we don't know that there's a designer. And that's the idea. Just because we don't understand certain things about the universe or the cell or something doesn't mean that we can't tell that it's the cell or the universe isn't designed. We can tell. We have ways to tell. And so the ID proponent states that when we do not understand and when we do understand the physics, invoking Henry Ford is permitted because all of the mechanisms, all of the parts we know and all the parts we don't, reveal his genius. We can see the genius of Henry Ford when we look at the car engine, for instance. And so we are justified in invoking Henry Ford, even though we may not understand everything about it, even though we have gaps in our knowledge. So Henry Ford, in this sense, is the agent behind the mechanism and is not reducible to the mechanism itself. Henry Ford is not the engine. Henry Ford is a person who's dead now who lived. Ford is the explanation. Henry Ford, he's the explanation for the existence of the mechanism. And the same thing could be said about, say, evolution. God could be easily thought of as the explanation of the mechanism of evolution, granting evolution is what's taking place. And I'm not saying it does, I'm just saying that for the sake of argument. And likewise, we can say then, to hash this out fully, that God is the agent behind the mechanism of the universe. He is the foundation and explanation of it all, including our rationality to do science itself, including our rationality to talk about morality, including our rationality to talk about philosophy or logic or common sense or building a building or such. Similar examples, you get the idea. Now, if you go to page 31, there's one last thing I want to say. And the rest of this chunk is actually just additional kind of background information starting at page 33. But if you look at page 31, you can see there's a couple more responses that I have to the criticism, God of the gaps, this charge that it's God of the gaps. I would love to go into this, but I won't. But I'll summarize it for you in those last couple minutes here. The first response is that, again, we're not saying that God caused it. These are responses, again, who by ID proponents who don't imply God created the universe. These are just saying that there's design. I don't know how it got there, but it looks designed based on specified complexity. So they say, well, aliens could have done it. Other gods, many gods, could have done it. So there's that. So there's not a God of the gaps. It's just that we're inferring design, and what implication is drawn after that, we don't know. We don't care. So the God of the gaps charge is not applicable. It doesn't even apply. So the naturalist who says God of the gaps, it doesn't work, because most of the time, ID proponents don't imply God at all. They just infer design. Design and leave it at design. They don't go the next step. The second thing I want to say is that this charge God of the gaps is really kind of a name-calling thing. Not name-calling like you're a jerk, but more just like a kind of meant to be like insulting. Kind of like, oh, this is just God of the gaps. You silly primitive human. You're just appealing to some god like the fertility gods or the moon god or something. So that's kind of the idea when this is usually brought up. And this just misrepresents the view completely. It's not a supernatural inference. Again, we could think of it as natural causes, and is design involved, relied on, or dependent on, or required? So a supernatural is not even part of the conversation. Appeal to natural causes only is biased, and that's what the supernatural says. If you see that highlighted portion there, do you see that there? Kind of most of the way down. It says, resorting to the supernatural violates a major canon of modern science, explained only through natural causes. Again, this is Eugenie Scott, who's head of the National Center for Science Education. And she says, you can only explain through natural causes. And that, again, is this naturalism just brought out fully. And we can say in response to that, first, there's no inference to the supernatural, but an inference to the best explanation of ID. And second, this statement is based on a priori metaphysical position that has already been shown to be unwarranted as we went through naturalism. So that charge that, you can't infer something that's not natural. You can only infer chance and necessity. You can never get down to the bottom. That's what she's saying. I don't care about your explanatory filter. I don't care about your flowchart. You just can't do that. You can't infer something that's not natural. Again, that's based on naturalism, which is a worldview. It's a priori metaphysical position, not scientific. Now, the next two charges, again, I won't read them, but basically the naturalist is actually guilty of the same charge that he is charging the ID proponent with. He appeals to the God of the future when trying to explain the fossil record and other gaps in our knowledge, such as maybe even this amino acids turning to enzymes, things like that. They're appealing to the God of the future that one day we will figure this out if we haven't, since our evidence at the moment isn't very sufficient. And then the other thing that could be said is that they're also guilty of this charge by appealing to the God of the multiverse, which happens when we're talking about the origin of the universe. And they say that there's a bunch of multiverses, and that's how we explain our universe being equipped for life and so-called fine-tuned. And so they're actually appealing to this multiverse, and I'm calling it the God of the multiverse. And so it could be shown that the naturalist is actually guilty of committing the same fault, if you will. Whereas when they charge the ID proponent with it, it's inapplicable and it's irrelevant to what the ID proponent is actually doing. Okay, so that completes the intro to intelligent design. Next week we are going to talk about biochemistry, this sort of stuff, specified complexity, irreducible complexity, and criticisms of evolution. We're going to get into that in the next few weeks, and we're going to start talking about cosmology, fine-tuning, and we'll even touch on how the universe is said to have originated from the naturalistic worldview. And there's different theories, such as the multiverse, that are out there. And we're going to look at those and show criticisms of those. So those are the next few weeks. So I kind of brought those things up at the very end to kind of whet your appetite and give you some food for thought. And that's kind of what we're going to get into now. We're going to actually start looking at this stuff. Yes, sir.
I have a question by way of an analogy.
Okay.
So I'm hiking through a forest.
Yes.
And I'm getting tired.
Okay.
And I think, boy, it'd be really nice if I had some sort of a cane so I can help get through this forest, right?
Okay.
And exactly that moment, I happened upon a stick on the ground. And this stick is like the perfect fit. It is the perfect height, weight, depth, bent the perfect way. There's like a knob on the top that comes off of the side. It's got little spaces, perfectly spaced for my hand for each of my knuckles.
Okay.
It has like another knob on this side that has like a horseshoe shape so I can hang my canteen on it. It's like perfect. And I think if I went into a workshop right now to build myself a cane for walking, I would not be able to make myself any more perfect cane.
Okay.
Right? Perfect. Flawless.
Yeah.
Is it rational for me to conclude? Well, given the laws of probability and the odds of me finding or making even something that's perfect for my own walking style and hand and everything else, is it rational for me to conclude, well, there must be a benevolent, omniscient force, a supernatural force in the universe that knew I was going to be walking and that this very moment I would feel this tiredness and need a cane of some sort? Or is it more rational for me to conclude, well, I know it's highly improbable, but given the number of forests on the planet, the number of trees in those forests, the number of branches on those trees, the number of branches that fall off those trees, even though it's very, very, very improbable, it is still more likely that that this branch formed naturally and happened to be here when I came by. Which is the more rational way to do that?
That's an interesting question, because what it's tapping into is this idea of, I think you're making an analogy of someone can infer design or someone can infer chance.
Right.
But here's the interesting thing is that this design inference approach, based on the explanatory filter and that other argument structure I pointed out at the beginning, it's not talking about analogy, like, for instance, Paley's watch, if you're familiar with that. So it kind of, because it kind of sounds like that, how you presented it. And so that's the classical teleological argument for design. It's a philosophical argument made from analogy. And Hume, if you may recall, talked about that. And many people say Hume refuted it, but many other people say, heck no, Hume was terrible, and here's why, you know. So this whole philosophical argument for the existence of God as a teleological argument is actually not what's happening in this approach that I'm presenting. But you are presenting the teleological argument for God that William Paley brought up a couple hundred years ago. Now, the reason why I'm not talking about that right now is because Hume responded to that, and then there was responses to Hume. And so that's a whole philosophical conversation, and it takes a long time to draw it out. And I'm not trying to dodge the question, but I'm just saying that when we get to the philosophical apologetics class next year, we're actually going to be talking about the teleological argument for God for several weeks, because so much of philosophical literature of the past 2,000 years, even back to the ancient Greeks, they even brought that same thing up before William Paley and Hume and everybody. And so there's just an ocean of literature out there on that, the analogy. Now, the last page, I do bring up this analogy thing, which is exactly what you said, right there on page 34. It says argument from analogy, and you just spelled it out. And so, one intuitively, my quick response is one intuitively would say, oh, that's design, because look at it, it's got everything there. But someone could say, well, yeah, but it, obviously it fell from the tree and made this dent in the leaves, you know, we could see that it's not. And so, there's criticisms of Paley's classical teleological argument that are good criticisms, but then there's also really good responses. And so, you know, that's just a long conversation. But it's a good, I mean, you're bringing up something that is exactly where I would like to have touched on with page 34 and 35. And you can kind of see my little flow of thought there, but it's just such a huge conversation. But that's not what's happening here. I'm just trying to, it's a great question. I'm trying to point out to the class, but this is a different flow of thought than that. Yes, sir.
I I think maybe what is being presented is that it doesn't have to be the idea of design, doesn't have to be a realistic outcome of that. Either it's a phenomenal design or the number of trees that is designed. You know, there's all these different versions. Like one could say as a third option or a fourth or fifth is that some guy just lost his walking stick and he found it. So basically that it was designed, but it doesn't have to be by. So that goes into the nature of the presentation when self-design is not, doesn't have to be pigeonholed into the reality. It's just the idea of someone who is designed.
What about the type when like something that occurs in nature is detrimental to the organism?
Yeah.
You know, you have animals where they have teeth that continually grow.
So one of the first things we said about design, if you remember last week, and I don't mean to short circuit your question, but I think I know where you're going, is just that one of the initial misconceptions is that intelligent design means optimal design. And Michael Shermer, who you may know is president of Skeptic Society, whatever, he brought that up in a radio interview. But that's exactly not what intelligent design theorists think. Intelligent design doesn't mean so intelligent that it's optimal. It's not that. Optimal design is not intelligent design.
Detrimental.
Because, again, all intelligent design is doing is saying, does naturalistic processes rely on this design idea or not? And so there could be detrimental features of the universe. And in fact, many call junk DNA, there's certain parts of junk DNA. But now we know that what we thought of as junk DNA is not junk DNA. It actually has a purpose. But to the point, well, how could something be intelligent designed if it's not optimal or if it's detrimental? Well, intelligent design doesn't depend on this concept of the design being perfect. It just says, does it have design? And if you think about it, nothing is optimally designed. And I work in structural engineering, and I could tell you that for sure. I work for the biggest engineering firm in the world, and I've been doing it for 10 years. Nothing is optimally designed. All of resources are misused because of other issues. There's give and take.
Sure, but it's not optimally designed, but you wouldn't put a button on it. Like, if you're building a building, you wouldn't put a button on it that causes the entire building to explode, and it happens on a random time. Like, you wouldn't.
Okay, well, then that's, then we'll, when someone brings that up,
I think that's
just like the ID proponent will talk about, well, what is that? Let's talk about that, you know, and start looking at the thing itself and take it by case basis. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to conclude because people are falling asleep over here. She's falling over. All this stuff is happening. It's chaotic. Okay, let's do something real quick. Dear Lord Jesus, thank you for tonight. We pray that you would help us get out of here safe and sound and keep our sanity. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.